VinePair's New York City headquarters, I'm Adam Teeter.
And I'm Joanna Sciarrino.
And in Seattle, Washington, I'm Zach Jabal.
And this is the VinePair Podcast. Guys, we've gotten a lot of feedback from the Monday episode.
Who could have guessed?
It's been an interesting week.
Yeah, but I think it has. It has. But you know, lots of people who, you know, have thoughts on both sides of the issue, which is great, which is what we set out to do here at VinePair. But one thing that's a little bit of an update here is the person we were talking about in that episode was the sommelier Patrick Capiello. And he and I have been texting all day today, actually, as we're recording this podcast. And he's going to come on the pod in a few weeks. Hopefully we're going to do it in early May, hopefully the first week of May, around May 1st or so. He's going to come on and we're going to talk to him about a lot of the opinions he's been putting out there on Instagram and, what he has to say about the industry, and hopefully have a really good conversation about what we had to say as well, and talk about, you know, not just the state of American wine, but sort of this, I'd love to hear his perspective too on like the state of America, of the American sommelier. I think, you know, there was another pretty prominent piece where he's interviewed for the Rob Report, where he talks about, you know, the culture of bullying in wine and mm-hmm. feeling like he was bullied in the whole sort of like natural wine world. So I want to talk about that too, because we hear about that a lot in wine specifically as it being sort of a very big bullying culture amongst sort of more prominent wine personalities over others. So I think it'll be a really good conversation. So I just wanted to let everyone, you know that so they can put it on their calendars and get ready. But let's move on from that conversation from Monday and chat this week. And to kick those things off, Zach, what have you been reading on the site?
So I think, you know, there's a couple of great things as always, but I was really enjoyed.
Yeah. All credit to Joanna.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's but if only we had the editor in chief on here to talk about why she. Scheduled all these things. No, the Thomas Berry's piece about the four equal part cocktail. My God, I could not get that out of my mouth. Just really interesting. It's a drink construction that I really love. The Last Word was a really important cocktail for me and kind of getting me interested in bartending and in craft cocktails. And I think in general, a lot of the drinks that I found most captivating in a way and that really capture the magic of what great bartending can be fit into this template. And it was really interesting to read about it and read about not only the ones that were popular, have become popular, have been created, but a few of those that have gone by the wayside, which is also kind of fun too. There's just a lot of interesting history in there. So yeah, definitely enjoyed reading that one.
Yeah, I like that one too.
Joanna, how about you?
I liked from last week, we did something new with our Hop Take column, which is from Dave Infante, but we did a quarterly. Did you talk about this last week? I can't remember.
No.
We did a quarterly report card where Dave kind of reviews how the beer business is doing so far this
yeah.
year. And he kind of compiles a lot of the columns that he's published already in this year. But yeah, it's as always a very, you know, smart piece of journalism. Dave does a really good job. So I really liked working on that and like that piece. And then as of today, as you're listening to this, our latest techniques column will be live on the site. That's a really great one with Jack Schramm, whose column that is. And this time it's with Orlando McCray from Night Moves in Brooklyn about building a smarter back bar and how you highlight ingredients too. So what about you, Adam?
You know which one I'm going to say.
Which?
It's the Aaron Goldfarb piece.
Yeah.
This time about rat. Well, God.
Well,
Zach,
I'm just saying, like, I can just drop that in the transcript from now on.
Adam will talk about Aaron's piece.
Yep.
I liked this one about raspberry flavored Campari that they made until sort of the 80s. 1992, yeah, mm-hmm. Which is really cool, and I did not know existed, and also did not know that there are now people out there searching for it. Mm-hmm. I think I reading the piece, I now have this memory of a few years ago of Aaron telling me this story about being in Berlin and seeing this on the back bar of the hotel he was staying at, and like asking for a taste of it, and then just being like, yeah, sure, whatever, and then charging him €5 for it, and I will say, like, that is still what's just, I love the piece and you should read it. But then what it also reminded me of is how fun that can be sometimes when you're in a random place and you just see something they forget they had. So this actually happened to Josh and I in Vegas where they, the bar inside the now Park MGM when it used to be like a, I forget what the hotel was before it was Park MGM, but whatever. it was not Circus Circus, but they had like a Mexican themed bar inside the casino. And when they redid the entire casino and rebranded, et cetera, they inherited a bunch of the liquids. And one of the things they had inherited was like a very, very old barrel pick of Patron Añejo from the original bar.
Wow.
And Josh and I saw it on the back bar, and like the bartender like didn't even know what it was. He'd forgotten it was up there.
Mm-hmm.
And he pulled it out, and we were like, can we have a pour of that? And he was like, yeah. And so he poured us 2 ounces, and then he brought the bill, and it was like $12. Because it probably was still
Patron.
it was probably just Patron and like what was in the system or whatever. And we were like, this was awesome. Mm-hmm. Like very, and it was just cool to drink something that probably was from sometime, you know, in the early 2000s or whatever when they'd done the barrel pick.
Mm-hmm.
So it was cool. I like that kind of stuff when you have those discoveries.
Yeah, it's fun.
I also think we have to give a quick shout out to the art on the meat cocktails piece. One of the more striking visuals on the site in a while.
Yeah, that was pretty intense. Pretty intense. So today we're going to do – so we've been getting a lot of amazing listener questions. Thank you so much for sending those in. And today we are going to do two of them because we think they're both really great, but probably you know we can bang out two on a Thursday. So Zach, you want to kick us off with our first question?
Hey Adam, Zach, and Joanna, Brittany here, longtime listener and lover of the pod. I'm reaching out after reading David Fonte's recent piece asking if 2024 is at last the year of hard cider. I'm curious, with consumers caring about sustainability and clean labels and thoughtful ingredients and authentic stories, and especially with some smaller regional contenders coming onto the scene and taking on mass market ciders of years past, I'm curious, is there room for optimism in the craft cider space in the near future?
I think because this is Cider Brittany, I'm going to let Joanna take a stab at this first. just because, like, I want to be aware that some of the listeners think I can be negative sometimes, and I don't want to go there. Everyone who's a regular listener knows my feelings on cider. I would love to answer this as well, but I think it's not fair to the question to not let someone else take it first. So, Joanna, what do you think?
I don't know. I'm looking back over Dave's piece, who, after returning from CiderCon?
CiderCon.
Is that what it's called? CiderCon.
Yeah, Zach was there, too.
Yeah, I was there.
He was there, too. We know.
Picking apples.
He wrote this piece that maybe 2024 would be cider's year. And I think he makes a few good points in this piece. Where beyond beer, full-flavored beverages, like... That seems to appeal to people, a lot of people at this point. But I don't know. I think there still is a long way. Like, it's a big opportunity, right? But I think there's just a long way to go for mass market consumer buy-in.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting. You know, I, as mentioned, was at CiderCon with Dave and had a lot of interesting thoughts after that. We've discussed some of them on the pod, but I think to elaborate a little bit on something that I've found really interesting in doing a little bit more digging, talking to a few people in the cider industry, is that one of the most interesting and kind of explosive growth areas in cider are imperial ciders. And you see a lot of what I would call the sort of Voodoo Ranger effect here, where these ciders are often, you know, 8-9% ABV in that range and are absolutely killing it at C-stores where they are available. And, you know, there's a few producers. I think Schilling Cider here in the Seattle area is the current, like, industry leader wherever they are, you know, in a lot of Western states. And I think it's really interesting because the West Coast in particular has always been a little more amenable to cider than most of the rest of the country. Maybe not surprisingly, because a lot of apples are grown here. Obviously not exclusively here. Apples are grown throughout much of the country. But especially when you look at kind of what percentage of the sales cider makes up in the places like chain grocery and convenience stores here in on the West, it is a significantly bigger percentage than in, you know, most of the rest of the country. And I do think these imperial ciders make a certain kind of sense to the market, especially some of the ones that have additional fruit flavors besides just kind of apple. Again, they deliver like a higher ABV than a lot of people are looking for in these products. They are overtly fruit forward in their flavor profile, again, kind of matching what people are looking for. And I think cider does have one compelling kind of argument to make for itself in this space, which is it's a fruit product in and of itself, right? And so there is a kind of, whether known or just kind of subconscious synergy for drinkers of I'm drinking a fruit flavored product that's made from fruit. And some drinkers obviously don't care. Some drinkers are going to gravitate towards fruit flavored products that are, you know, FMBs, they're going to be, or they're, you know, spirit based seltzers, etc. But I think some drinkers are drawn to the notion that, you know, the product is fruit based in its origin. And there is some compelling logic. You know, one of the head of Schilling told me when I was talking to him that, you know, one of the other big advantages that he sees for cider is that cideries are familiar with dealing with fruit. And if they're working with actual fruit product, they have a you know, in some cases, the equipment and the machinery and just the know-how in terms of fermenting or otherwise adding those flavors to their product that perhaps a brewery, a distillery, whatever else is making beverage alcohol these days might not have. So I think there's possibility there. I think, you know, cider has some of those inherent advantages. Really, one of the big issues for them has been regulatory, and mm-hmm. that's not really worth getting into, but cider has struggled because it's taxed a little differently than beer. It's taxed more like wine, but it also isn't given the flexibility that beer is until hopefully soon to put packaging or put product in certain packaging that beer can use, which is weird. And again, a great example of how deeply convoluted and kind of fucked up our liquor laws are in this country.
Yeah.
Okay, Brittany. So
Adam was just listening to respond there.
No. I think that, like, from everything that Dave has said, Zach, et cetera, like, the cider community is a very supportive, inclusive place, which is great. And I think, you know, everyone who makes cider really wants cider to be a thing. But I think cider is the perfect example for me of a situation where there are people who really want to make it and there just is not enough consumer demand for it ever to be that big. And I don't think that's going to change. And the biggest thing that I think cider fights against is actually its distribution pathway in terms of its end channel. Yeah. What I mean by that is cider has become, in American sort of pop culture, it is the gluten-free option at most bars. And the problem with that is that, so what I mean by that is the beverage professionals at most bars, and I would say at some restaurants that, again, don't have wine because wine's also gluten-free, but it's like we're talking about beer bars, et cetera, right, that want to have stuff on draft, have basically labeled cider as the easiest solution for someone who comes in and says they can't drink these because they're gluten-free. The issue with getting that label, which is the label that cider has now had for at least 15 years, is that you only need one gluten-free option. So what does that mean? That means that every single bar only needs one cider line. Mm-hmm. And so every cider brand is competing for one tap line.
Yeah.
And the only way that you grow in beverage alcohol is through, like we say this all the time, most brands are built on the on-premise. Mm-hmm. They just are. There are a few brands that get built in off-premise, but most brands are built in on-prem. The biggest companies believe this. The smallest companies believe this. A lot of that is about having that first interaction, having that recommendation from a bartender, a beverage professional, a shopkeeper, right? And then you buy. Then maybe a wine store, liquor store recommends it as well, and you sort of are like, oh, wow, yeah, I had this before at a bar down the street. Like, a great company building a brand, you know, is both in a bunch of different bars in a neighborhood and then also in a bunch of different stores. So then when you experience their product in the bar, you can then go to the store and buy it. But most bars just only need the one line. So that doesn't leave a lot of opportunity for a lot of cider, you know, companies to build their brands. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't. And they are also competing against the large companies, of which Angry Orchard is a massive behemoth, yeah, and a few others who already are in the bar with their other beers.
Yeah.
And so it's a lot easier to then just add the draft line of Angry Orchard than it is to, you know, have some of the Boston beer products and then go for some crazy local cider that most consumers don't care about. Because what the bartender thinks is most consumers who are drinking the cider are just there. They got dragged to the bar with their friends and they're there to watch the game or whatever, and they need the gluten-free option. Mm-hmm. And
it's going to be more expensive.
It's going to be more expensive. And the amount of consumers that really care about cider is just very small, unfortunately. we've talked about this before. It's why we see these cider-focused restaurants, even in New York, go out of business or struggle and adapt and change because, you know, it's in our popular culture or beverage culture, rather, never been a category that we think of in terms of spending money on like we do spirits and wine.
Yeah.
To be fair, we don't really think of that for beer either, right? That's why you saw the epic failure when Ballast Point went national at a much higher price point. You don't see a lot of beers in 750 milliliters sold at bars and restaurants, and people say, oh, you know, these are age worthy and super expensive because they're imperial stouts. Right? People don't generally want to spend that on those kinds of liquids. Right, they're willing to spend it on wine. They're willing to spend it on spirit, and cider can be, as Zach has mentioned, just as expensive.
Yeah.
Right, especially for some of the most interesting ciders that I've ever had, you know, are the ones that approach fine wine pricing, and it's just we do not have a history with this beverage that tells us that we should be spending that, even if it is what it should cost.
Yeah.
And that makes it very difficult because you just are never then going to have a critical mass that's going to be willing to move into the category. Yeah. I don't think.
I think that also outside of the price, because I think that there are probably more affordable ciders out there and the quality is quite good. I think we also just struggle with knowing the drinking occasions for cider.
Yeah, totally.
And I think back to your anecdote where somewhat recently you were served, like, you went to a fine restaurant and you were served, like, sparkling cider, right, instead of, like, champagne at the beginning. And I think that that's, like, if cider is getting onto a fine dining menu, like, it's probably really hard for that kind of placement on a restaurant menu. And if you think about any kind of restaurant menu in the drinks list, like, how many ciders can actually, if any at all, right, do you encounter on like a wine list or a beverage menu, right? So then it's like the on-premise thing again. If it's not going to be in the beer bar, or if there's one in the beer bar, it's probably not, or the brewery or whatever, like, and it's hard to get onto a restaurant menu, like, what are the real opportunities for on-premise?
Yeah, because it's not in like the culture of drinks.
Right.
Especially
like, when are you meant to drink cider?
Like, I just think too, like, if the way that it's getting in there is as, so at the place that I was at, right, it was sort of like they were using it as their welcome drink that they were just giving people, which is really nice. But let's say that one of the other ways it could happen is it's
part of a pairing.
Exactly.
Maybe.
We all know that Zach and I don't like the wine pairings. But like, let's say that it is. I can guarantee you that 9 out of 10 people who paid for the wine pairings and the first thing they get is a sparkling cider will feel completely cheated. Again, I don't think that's totally fair to cider, but it just is what it is. They would be much happier with a sparkling wine from anywhere else in the world, even not champagne, maybe not Prosecco if it's a very expensive tasting menu, right? There, you can tell them it's a high-end aged Spanish cava, whatever. But they're looking for a sparkling wine. And if you bring them a cider, and you're like, hey, this is a vintage cider. It's been aging on the lees for X amount of years and blah, blah, blah. And it has the fact that you're having to explain to them why it is enough for them to be like, nope, I paid for the $80 pairings or the $150 pairings, and I wanted you to bring at this point a half a glass of fucking champagne.
Yeah,
that's what I wanted.
So I want to say a couple things, and that to address that last point, I think you make a really good example. It's a really good example of how context really matters for almost any drink, but especially things that don't have that immediate cachet like cider. You know, being served a glass of sparkling cider with the sort of tossed off line of like, oh, it's our welcome drink, it's like champagne, is going to leave people generally feeling cold, even if they are perhaps inclined to enjoy cider. It still feels, it feels a little chintzy, quite honestly. And that said, as someone like me who does enjoy cider quite a bit, I think the question about the one tap line is definitely something that cider is aware of and something that producers are and, distributors, et cetera, are trying to work on. And I was actually, thinking back a little bit about my experience putting cider in beverage programs. And, there was a time when I had a tap line at one of the restaurants that was always for cider, kind of for the gluten-free option, also just because I thought it was interesting. And again, being here, there were a fair number of interesting draft ciders that we could put on. And without a doubt, the single most popular draft cider that we had, and this is now, probably a decade ago almost, was a pineapple cider. And people went, people loved it. People who would not normally have ordered cider went for it. And I probably should have learned more from that experience, honestly, which would have been like, hey, you know, there is a real market for these kind of flavorful mm-hmm. fruit forward ciders that could really perhaps be compelling to people. And I do think that what cider is trying to do is make an argument that, okay, maybe you don't have a tap list full of ciders, but maybe you need to have two. Maybe you need to have a traditional drier style cider, and you also need to have a fruited cider or something that's more flavor forward. And again, whether that's going to land with every establishment is going to, you know, really depend on how many draft lines they have, what they see the opportunity being there. But I think there is a notion that if you can crack that door open a little bit, it can have pretty big impacts. And the other one I will say is, undeniably, there is an issue for cider of a sort of, it's not just a pricing issue, and it's not even just an occasion issue. It's a sort of serving size and serving format issue. And again, because cider can fall, you know, pretty along a pretty wide spectrum of flavors, even if we're not including stuff that has other fruit added to it, and, you know, ABVs and sort of degrees of sweetness or dryness and all these things, it can be actually very difficult to just sort of put a cider in front of someone and in a pint glass or whatever and sort of say, like, here you go. And again, that is, as Adam was pointing out at the beginning, like, that is kind of how cider first got some traction, right? It was, here is your thing that looks like a beer, comes in a beer glass, but isn't beer because you can't drink beer. And moving out of that or away from that or building some space for cider beyond that has been tricky, because a lot of the other stuff is more analogous to wine but isn't wine. And I think actually price is its biggest barrier, not because it's too expensive, but because it's too cheap. If you are a restaurant, does it really make sense to devote list space, service kind of attention, and, you know, just kind of everything that goes with it to sell a bottle of cider, a $7.50 or whatever of cider, that in most cases isn't going to cost as much as a bottle of wine? I mean, there are inexpensive bottles of wine and there are expensive bottles of cider, but I don't think you can find a bottle of cider that would retail, and again, retail, not restaurant list, retail for even $75. I mean, it probably exists out there, but they are very, very, very few and far between. And many of them are going to be even on a restaurant list with a hefty markup in that $50 to $60 range. And yeah, that's something, but a restaurant would quite rightly prefer to sell you a $150 bottle of wine than a $50 bottle of cider. And mm-hmm. I think that has always been one of the barriers, because beverage professionals are tasked with a lot of things, but one of them is making money for the establishment they work at. And I think cider has a hard time doing that. I think it's why cider does really well, at least, like I said, from the data I was looking at, in grocery, in chain retail, in C-stores, and it doesn't do as well on-prem, because it's a hard value proposition on-premise.
Right. And in those C-stores and things like that, it is these flavored ciders.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think there's an opportunity for the people who are looking outside of, who are open to having things outside of wine, beer, and spirits, right? There are so many beverages out there and available to people now. So I think there's a willingness to try new things, that's for sure. But I don't know if that will translate into 2024 being cider's year.
No, but maybe 2025 when someone launches the Stella Rosa version of cider.
Ooh, yeah. Well, my big take is really from all this is someone needs to be making more like a slightly more, I don't know, whatever, craft version of Stella Rosa. Like, someone is going to make a killing in the wine industry besides Stella Rosa making fruited wine.
Fruited wines, yeah.
Yeah, and I've been telling everyone I know this, so I'm saying it on the pod too, so now you all can know this. I really believe that there is an opportunity there. maybe not the pineapple chili one that we had, but I do think there is a... obviously, although that's also killing it, like, it's what people want. I don't know what to tell you.
All right, Zach, let's play that next question.
Hey, gang, this is Karan from Toronto. I hope you guys are doing well, and I'm loving the pod as usual. Adam, I hate to admit this because it will go straight to your head, but you're on my dream dinner guest list. What can I say? I'm a sucker for strong opinions and a sense of humor. Anyway, I was wondering what you guys predict the drink of the summer is going to be this year. Is it going to be Aperol Spritz again, or are we going to have something new in store? Look forward to hearing from you.
Well, I mean, I'm just honored.
You're going to take a trip up to Toronto just to... I mean, I can't believe this. Joanne actually goes to Canada regularly.
Just proves that Canadians have really good taste.
I got to say,
Joanna?
I've had dinner with Adam, and he's an okay guest.
Yeah, I'm a good
guest.
I've
had dinner with him, too.
Yeah. All right. It's just... that was a good one. Anyone else... compliment me and you definitely will play your question on the pod. So, drink of the summer. What do we think?
Cider?
How about a martini outside?
Yeah.
Martinis outside.
Ask
no,
Zach.
This,
Ask
this is Zach. What do you think about having a martini outside?
Outdoors.
So this is actually, I think, a fascinating question. Some weirdly, this came up in a conversation I was having with someone else not that long ago about like, can, because I think, oh, someone was talking to me about, they were talking about the comment you made, I guess it was on maybe it was just our last episode, my God, time flies, about how, you know, like the issue with the tip top Mai Tai was like, can you have it?
Oh, yeah.
You know, can you have it out of the can or whatever? Or do you need like all the accoutrement? And someone was saying like, what about RTD martinis and stuff like that? And I was like, I do think that the challenge for the martini is like, you kind of don't feel like you're having a martini unless you have it like, you know, with a, out of a martini glass with a garnish. And not that you can't do those things outside. I am sure people will decamp to various outdoor locations and, you know, pull out their, whip out their little cooler full of, you know, garnishes and their whatevers. I think, you know, that's kind of fun in its own way, but I don't know. To me, like the martini is a drink that you should enjoy when it's dark outside. That's kind of like my martini hot take.
But like, could you still have it outside?
At night? Sure. Yeah. Why not?
Okay. There's a hot take opinion on staff that you can never, by one staff member who is the resident martini expert, I would argue.
Who argues, how could we ever guess who that is?
That you could you should never drink a martini outside. And then, I don't know if anyone else is watching Fallout, but in episode 6, because Naomi and I just like speeding through it. It's entertaining. Walt and Goggins, man. That's why you got to watch it.
You know I'm not a fan.
You don't like Walton Goggins?
I do not.
I forgot about this.
There's something about him. Evan loves him so much.
Oh, he's so good. I'll tell Evan to watch Fallout.
I know.
Another Canadian I really like. they drink martinis in that one episode twice outdoors. And it just so happened that I watched it the night he had given this very hot take opinion.
So wait, so Tim actually thinks like if he were going out to dinner somewhere.
You could never, not, like, if you're outside and there were martinis, it's a climate thing.
Yeah.
That basically, like, a martini is meant to be served ice cold and you want to be in the air conditioning when consuming it, is what he said. You don't want to be outdoors
and
where it's warm.
It can't be winter.
Yeah, and it can't be winter. So anyways, I just, oh, Tim. Great opinion. But so that's definitely not going to be the drink of summer.
No.
I mean, I do think that one of the things we're going to continue to see, it may feel like in certain major metros, like New York, Seattle, San Francisco, Toronto, that the Aperol Spritz has come and gone, but I think the Spritz as a whole, if you look at all of the forward-looking data we have here at VinePair, is going to just explode this summer even more so. But I think you're going to see more variations of the Spritz, so not just Aperol. I think, look, Aperol grew 40% last year, so it's still growing, but I think you might see the Hugo Spritz went viral last year on TikTok. I don't know if it necessarily was everywhere, but it went viral on TikTok. But I think you're going to see a lot of other people who are very much like spritz, no matter the flavor. Like there's the Limone Spritz, there's the Hugo Spritz, there's the Aperol Spritz. I'm seeing people talking about it with grapefruit. There's people talking about it with tequila. Like there's people who are kind of leaning into the spritz. There's a lot of places that I've been talking to reps and things like that, saying that, you know, they're hearing from restaurants that they're doing all spritz menus this summer. They're already planning all spritz menus.
Interesting.
So again, I think a lot of spritz variations as opposed to just like what you saw even 3 or 4 summers ago, which is that there was an Aperol Spritz on every menu, but then there was a lot of other cocktails. Now I think there's like going to be a menu with 4 or 5 or 6 spritzes. And I think that one of the places that it's going to really win this summer is at brunch. That you're going to see a lot of spritzes at brunch, and that is going to usurp mimosas and
Bloody Marys
and things like that for it at brunch in the summer.
So like a bottomless spritz setup?
Bottomless spritz, or like a lot of people have talked to me about how they think they're going to see, especially at like the not bottle service-y clubs, but let's say like sort of like day party type hangs, these like make your own spritz kits that come to the table. That's like, here's your bottle of aperitif, here's your bottle of sparkling wine. Potentially, if you know, like certain spritzes don't use sparkling water, some do. So then here's your bottle of sparkling water, here's ice, here's glasses, like party. And I think you will see that at beach clubs. I think you'll see that in Miami. Like that's definitely going to be a thing. So the spritz will definitely, as a category, still be probably the dominant drink category this summer, I think.
I think that's a good idea. I think that's smart. What do you think, Zach?
I was thinking a lot about this in terms of, you know, we talked about the Aperol Spritz in particular before about how, part of its appeal is, you know, the taste and all that, but a lot of it is the visual, right? Like, yeah. It's such a summery looking beverage, and it makes sense, right? It's striking color. It's, you know, served in a big glass with ice and all that stuff. Like, you feel like you're having, you know, it's summertime when you're having one, regardless of the time of year. And I was thinking about the visual component in particular, and I was thinking, like, what hasn't quite hit it super big yet that can deliver some of that visual pop, but is also maybe going to be a little bit distinct. And I don't know how you guys feel about this, but I think, like, we could have a big summer for Empress Gin, which is like the butterfly pea. It's like the purple gin.
Yep.
I think, like, it's been a thing that has, you know, certainly been out there. It's been out there for a number of years now. You see it on a lot of bar menus, but it's still, I think, really a, like, people are still figuring out kind of how best to apply it. Like, you see it as like a sort of gin and tonic type thing, which, you know, besides our thoughts on the gin and tonic, it is, like, I think, not really the ideal presentation for that, because you kind of lose some of the visual luster because it's diluted, quite honestly. I kind of, despite saying no martinis, I wouldn't be shocked by an Empress Gin martini being a big deal or something like that. But I just think of, like, even at, like, I guess an Empress Gin spritz, or, like, essentially a French 75 is really what I'm talking about here, with Empress Gin, being a really compelling option, because I think, again, it's just, like, it's so vivid, and so that kind of bright purple color is so summery to people. And you can kind of garnish it up with fruit. You can do all kinds of shit to it. It's very friendly in that regard. Yeah, I don't know. That's kind of where my head's at.
You were going to say the gin and tonic and just pulled back, didn't you?
No, because
visually, how do we see this coming together?
No, because I think
the easiest way is a purple gin and tonic.
In a big wine glass with ice and tonic?
Well, I mean, maybe, but I think that, again, I sort of stand by what I said, which is, like, I think part of what appealed to people about the Aperol Spritz, in addition to the color and the taste and all that, was also it was novel, right? And the gin and tonic is a drink that every last person on the fucking planet has heard of, right? And I think the Aperol Spritz was a discovery for most people, and that's partially what drove its success. It's, you know, all those other things too. And I think someone, you know, maybe it's a fucking Empress Gin Collins, which is basically just a gin and tonic, but slightly different. But something that people are not as familiar with, just the name of the drink or something like that, I think is going to be more successful than just a gin and tonic.
Interesting. So this is something that I've been thinking about for a little bit, but I haven't verbalized to anybody yet. But I do think that it's all in my head. So there was a Brewbound piece about lemon being the flavor right now, like such a big flavor. But I think that a big flavor for this year and this summer in particular is going to be peach.
Ooh. Yeah.
I've been seeing a lot of peach versions of things that exist already, mostly in, like, the canned space and beers, but also, like, flavor extensions in peach. And I just think that we're going to see more peach this summer. And it feels like a very summery.
The summer of Southern Comfort?
Or the summer of Crown Royal Peach.
Okay, fair, fair.
I mean, that's the big one.
Very popular.
I mean, I think you definitely see more peach. I mean, I think High Noon has a peach flavor. I mean, there's a lot of people with peach flavors.
Yeah, they do, but I feel like I'm seeing more as new line extensions.
I just, you know, peach for me always tastes too fake.
Artificial.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lemon at least gives you that, you know, even when it's fake tasting, it has like a, oh, this is lemon. Mm-hmm. Peach tastes fake.
Yeah.
But I definitely think that could be, I don't think there's going to be any other like major cocktail.
I know, because we're in such a hard martini moment.
In a hard martini moment, and with the espresso martini is like the night, even for summer, where it's like, okay, I day drank all day, and now I'm going out with friends on the weekend, and I'm on my vacation, and I need to have an espresso martini to like stay awake. The biggest thing that I find with the espresso martini that's been so interesting to me, which is a complete aside, which is how many people I talk to who love it and who drink it who are not coffee drinkers.
Huh.
Find it very interesting. I was just at dinner recently with a beverage executive who told me she discovered the espresso martini a year or two ago, and it's the first cocktail she orders now when she has to, like, when she has a night, like a business night out or whatever. Like, when she, that's her first cocktail, as opposed to like some people get a martini or a Negroni, whatever. And she's like, to give her energy for the night.
Hmm.
I'm like, oh, are you a coffee drinker? She's like, oh, no, I'm not a coffee drinker. It's so, I was like, okay, but you know you're just drinking coffee.
Well, there's, you know.
Which, I mean, clearly she does because she knows there's caffeine in it. But, like, it's a different – maybe it's that up or downer thing that that helps regulate it for some people, where they don't like how they just feel on coffee. But it's been very interesting to me, because me as a coffee drinker, as we all know, is not my favorite cocktail. But yeah, I don't know. Let us. I'm curious what other people think of in terms of the drink of the summer. I do think we're in such a martini moment that we will have a lot of martinis outside this summer.
Send your martini martini outside pictures to Tim.
He'd summer love to martini see you. And the martini outside. Let's make it happen. It's definitely gonna happen at least once, and he will have one. He will have one.
It's a poolside martini service. Love it.
Yeah, come on. How dope is that? Poolside martinis like the 1950s.
No.
I love it.
No, it's not an outdoor. I get it. It's not an outdoor drink.
I think the martini.
Because it's not a sessionable drink,
no,
right?
No, I think a martini with an olive, like a small, like, again, teeny teenies.
Yeah. Okay.
Dude, you get your snack.
Teeny teenies, teeny bikinis, the whole thing.
Dude,
someone's
going
to make that happen.
I think it's going to happen. And you know what? Boo on you, Tim.
Also, folks, please send us your questions. We love it. Podcast@findpair.com.
Thank you for always listening, for the compliments. They're great.
If anyone would like to invite Joanna or I out to dinner, I think we're open to.
I gotta get to Toronto. I've never been to Toronto before.
There you go.
I gotta go.
Good city.
Well, you know you have one dinner lined up.
At least one. At least one. All right. I'll talk to you both on Monday.
Have a nice weekend.
Sounds great.
Thanks so much for listening to the Vine Pair Podcast, the flagship podcast of the Vine Pair Podcast Network. If you love listening to this show, or even if you don't, but I really hope that you do, as much as we really do love making it, then please drop us a review or a rating wherever it is that you get your podcast, whether that be iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, anywhere. If you are listening to this on a device right now through an app, however you got this audio, please drop a review. It really helps everyone else discover the show. And now for some totally awesome credits. So, the Vine Pair Podcast is recorded in our New York City headquarters and in Seattle, Washington, in Zach Jabal's basement. It is recorded by Zach, mastered, and produced by Zach. He loves all the credit. Keep giving it to him. Drop his name in the reviews. He's going to love hearing how much you love him. It is also recorded in New York City by our tastings director, Keith Beavers, who is the managing director of the entire Vine Pair Podcast Network. I'd also love to give a shout out to our editor-in-chief, Joanna Sherino, who joins us on every single podcast as our third and most important host. Thank you as well to the entire Vine Pair staff and everyone who's been involved in making Vine Pair as special as it's become. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.